Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm Sue Fraser, representing the Press Club Committee. In the absence of our President, Don Riddell, would you please welcome our acting President, Rex Jory.
Thank you, Sue. I've got some good news for at least half the people in the room. Dr. Jane Lomax-Smith has just arrived. She said she was late because the taxation department is auditing doctors this year. So if any of you want to leave early or put your mobile phones on, then it may be appropriate. It's my pleasure today, in the absence of Don Riddell, our normal president, but that doesn't really work, who is again in Sydney. We're going to withdraw his South Australian passport shortly. To welcome you all, particularly to those who are here for the first time, and particularly those medicos who don't often have the joy and delight of rubbing shoulders with those of us from the press. It's a very simple format today. We will have our main course, call on the guest speaker soon after 1 o'clock, and there will be questions afterwards. There is a strong leaning, I might tell you, to the working press in the questions. Also, we have a raffle. We're essentially bankrupt as a club, so if you could help us, mostly booze and telephones as the prize, but it's a worthwhile cause, and I'd like to welcome you. Thank you, and I'll be up in half an hour or so. Thank you.
Thanks, Rex. And Rex, I'd just like to add to that comment that the Variety Club was actually audited by the tax department a couple of months ago on GST. I couldn't believe it, considering how meticulous we are. So they've got nothing better to do. I'd like to say on behalf of the Press Club Committee that we wish to acknowledge the support of Telstra, and there are two tables here from Telstra today. Would you please make them welcome and thank them for their ongoing support? Also, our thanks to Qantas for assistance with airfares for our guests when they're required, and to SA Brewing, who have provided for your enjoyment today Hahn Premium and Hahn Premium Light. Thank you, SA Brewing. Our wine sponsor is Orlando Wyndham, and today we are serving Jacobs Creek Reserve Chardonnay and Jacobs Creek Reserve Shiraz 1998. If you're not on our mailing list for future luncheons and you'd like to be, then just speak to Alison at the front desk and she'll make sure that you're there. Just hand her your business card or give her your details. Now to the raffle. The tickets are on your table. They are $2 each or 3 for $5. And today you could win for yourself. We have two Telstra phones here, a Telstra Panasonic cordless phone, a black one and a white one, worth winning, and I could afford to win that. Let me tell you, ours at home is just packed up. We have six bottles of Trilogy wines from Orlando Wyndham, the Trilogy being Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, Muscadel. That's a mouthful. And we've got that by two, so two lots of six. From Walter Rogers, the $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gouger Street. And if you love seafood, take yourself along to the Rock Lobster soon. And a $50 voucher from Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street, legendary home of fine Italian food. And a carton of Hahn Premium Light from SA Brewing. So there you go, and we'll be back soon. Enjoy your lunch.
Ladies and gentlemen, will the people on table 17 please be quiet? Ladies and gentlemen, isn't that marvellous? Thank you. Our guest speaker today, and I appreciate also that some of you are still eating, and maybe there's even one or two that haven't had their main course. They are on their way, I can assure you, but there are many people here today who need to get away right on 2 o'clock so they can get back to their taxation consultants and patients and other things. So we'll try to keep the schedule. Our guest speaker today was once asked by a journalist, and why he would want to know this I don't know, what do you eat during the day? And the answer was that she started with cereal and skimmed milk and salad and Chinese tea for lunch and much the same for dinner. Dr. Karen Phelps, who is sitting at my table, has had the Chardonnay and and had the beef. I haven't noticed a lot of salad or Chinese tea, and I was gratified that she was able to adjust her diet to the demands of the room. Dr. Phelps needs very little introduction, of course, but I think it's fair to say that this is the year of the political doctor. Dr. Phelps is known well in the media. She's a friend of the media, easy to contact from a journalistic point of view, visible on television, in magazines and other outlets. But I think she leaves her bedside manner behind when it comes to fighting for the demands not only of doctors and the profession, but also for the broader health service in Australia. If ever there was a year when the medical profession needed an aggressive spokesperson, I guess it's this year in South Australia. We have two elections in the next 12 months, and certainly the state election is going to be a battleground for issues such as health and education, and I would expect that Dr. Phelps will be here many times assisting the medical profession in its broad general terms in that battle. I'm sorry that we didn't have the salad and the Chinese tea, but I'm sure that nonetheless it'll be an entertaining address. Thank you, Dr. Phelps.
Thanks, Rex, and I suppose the press club is exactly the right place to talk about other questions that are asked by journalists, such as your own Philip Satchell this morning, who said to me, "Now, about this painting in the Archibald, what an intriguing painting, those beautiful dresses and topless." And I said, "I'm unorthodox, but I'm not that unorthodox, they're strapless." But you have to be prepared to deal with any questions that come your way, and there's no question today that I'll be very happy to take any of your questions after what I've had to say. So good afternoon, and thank you very much for welcoming me to Adelaide. I very much enjoy my visits to Adelaide, even the times I can't get to the wine country, as part of my diet, of course. And it's also, of course, with Adelaide, the city of churches, and I was thinking just how appropriate that is. I think we should all go out and visit whichever church you're affiliated with to say a prayer for the state of the health system in Australia, and South Australia is no exception. I think we're really at a stage where divine intervention is necessary. Nowhere are the problems more evident than here in South Australia. Even your Human Services Minister, Dean Brown, has had cause to be openly critical of his own coalition colleagues in the Federal Parliament over their failings in relation to health policy. And it's sometimes said that journalists, apart from asking unusual questions, spend their time chasing ambulances looking for a story. Well, if you were a journalist in Adelaide, you'd be hard-pressed to get your story written because the ambulances just don't stop. From what I hear, the ambulances drive around and around and around in search for a hospital bed for emergency patients. They get turned away, not only from public hospitals, where it's become a national pastime, especially in the capital cities, but the new thing is seeing private hospitals having to go on bypass too. This is not a sign of a healthy health system. In fact, I hear the ambulance traffic has meant that many Adelaide residents are beginning to think that the Grand Prix has returned to your fair city. If Bosworth Field were in Adelaide today, the call from Richard III would be, a bed, a kingdom for a bed. Dean Brown's recently announced Health Complaints Commissioner will certainly have his or her work cut out for them when they're appointed. Now, in the South Australian AMA's budget submission for 2001-2002, they've estimated that at least $160 million extra is needed to meet the basic needs of the South Australian public hospital system. Now, that's a lot of money. At the end of September 2000, there were 1,534 patients on waiting lists for more than 12 months, up from 601 in March 1999. So it's more than just about threefold increase. There were 228 accident emergency diversions between September 2000 and January 2001, and this number also is on the rise. It's not a pretty picture for South Australia. And it's not like these problems aren't being felt in the other states and territories too. It's an enormous national problem.
The underfunding impacts layer upon layer on patient care. Morale in our public hospitals is at a low that I've never seen before. There is a brain drain from the public hospital system to the private system as conditions get harder and harder and more frustrating as senior specialists struggle with limited budgets, outdated equipment, and the daily agony of deciding which patients will get to fit into artificially tight budgets rather than community health needs. Once, only a few short years ago, senior specialists wouldn't dream of working only in the private sector in Australia. Now it's becoming more and more likely to hear of talented surgeons, obstetricians and physicians walking away from the public hospital system because it's just too hard. This is a tragedy which may take generations to turn around, if ever. We don't want to see a two-tier health system, one for the haves and one for the have-nots. There are no hospital beds for emergency patients, ambulances doing laps of the city, aged care services at breaking point, and as already mentioned, there are waiting lists of more than a year for elective surgery. Add to this the broader problems of an outdated Medicare that's failing doctors and patients, the creeping corporatisation of medical practice, and the ridiculous situation with medical indemnity, and it's clear that we have a few problems. Add in unnecessary meddling by the notorious ACCC. Then there are the moves from certain quarters to embrace things like blended payments and fund holding. And you can see all the signs of managed care and the problem grows. Then throw in a health minister who's filed the relative value study, the RVS, in his bottom drawer, a health minister intent on causing divisions within the medical profession, and we have a huge problem. The federal minister has said, and I think he was trying to score points, that he's not the minister for doctors. Well, at the risk of stating the obvious, you can't run a health system without looking after the interests of the doctors and the nurses working in it. They tried that in the United Kingdom, and now they're finding they've run short of doctors to the extent that they have to offer big incentives to get doctors to come out of retirement to go back to work, and trawling the colonies for doctors to make up the shortfall. The other obvious issue is this. Exactly who is the Minister for Patients? The two issues go hand in hand. The AMA supported the government's support for the private health system. Not only did it encourage choice, but it has the real prospect of eventually, and I say eventually, relieving some of the pressure on the public hospital system. But the public system still needs a lot of catch-up funding. Our health system has the basic fundamentals pretty right, but it's in need of renovation. Not a patch-up job just covering up the cracks, but some serious policy work and substantial funding. The Australian people are not interested in band-aid solutions when corrective surgery is needed. That's all we've been getting, though. Band-aid surgery, band-aid solutions. We're not even talking about quality band-aids here. They're the cheap and nasty ones that look like they might work, but they peel off very quickly, having done nothing to help the damage, to heal the problems underneath. One example of this band-aid approach is last week's 50-cent Medicare rebate top-up from a packet of band-aids called the MOU, or the Memorandum of Understanding. The song and dance made of this 50-cent increase was remarkable, considering that this was money that belonged to general practice patients anyway from last year's budget that was underspent. Now, I'll explain why this little exercise needs to be renamed the MOM, the Memorandum of Misunderstanding. Why misunderstanding? Because the minister is talking to the wrong organisations about GP financing. Dr. Wooldridge has made much of the liaison between the three MOU organisations, who are fondly referred to in AMA circles because of the MOU, as the three Mouseketeers. And he's used their involvement in discussions on GP financing as a claim that he has the support of the profession in this exercise. So who's the leader of this club that's made for you and me? W-O-O-L-D-R-I-D-G-E. So to test the notion that he's talking to the wrong groups, The AMA conducted a survey last week asking GPs, members and non-members, urban and rural, who they want leading any discussions with government. The Mouseketeers scored 5.8% for the College of General Practitioners, 3% for the Rural Doctors Association, and a massive 1.2% for the Australian Divisions of General Practice. In contrast, the group excluded by the Minister from discussions on general practice because we wouldn't sign the MOU because we didn't agree with it, the AMA, we scored over 80%. That's what I call a mandate. And that's why the Memorandum of Misunderstanding is a cynical exercise. The only solution is for the Mouseketeers to decline any further involvement in the exercise and insist that the wishes of GPs are honoured, that the AMA lead discussions in consultation with the other GP groups. Until that happens, the MOM exercise is nothing more than a band-aid. And this is why the AMA will continue to push for real and lasting solutions to the crises facing the delivery of quality health and medical services in Australia. We will continue to strongly support the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners in its proper role in dealing with education and training. We support the roles of the divisions in GP education and service delivery, and we will continue to work with the Rural Doctors Association on important rural health issues. Which brings me to the Relative Values Study, or the RVS. It's at the top of the list of AMA priorities. We will push for implementation of the RVS in the May budget. The RVS has been an exhaustive 7-year study costing in excess of $10 million. It was started under the Labor government and continued under the present coalition government. The RVS is really the Medicare survival kit. It is the first comprehensive review of the Medicare benefits schedule of fees, the MBS, since its inception nearly 30 years ago. The AMA has been saying for some time now that the MBS is grossly outdated. Because the entire system of health funding, both private and public in this country, is linked back to the set of numbers in the Medicare benefit schedule, then you can see just how important it is to get it right. The RVS is about long-term solutions, not short-term fixes, not the band-aid approach. The AMA sees implementing the RVS as fundamental to the survival of the Australian healthcare system for at least the next 20 years or so. Doctors, like any workers, want adequate remuneration for their efforts. In fact, adequate is just not good enough. For a GP or other specialist to reach the stage in their careers when they can practice independently, it takes 6 to 8 years of university study, at least 2 years of basic hospital training, and then 4 or 5 years of advanced training. Throughout their postgraduate training, the hours are long for doctors, the work is emotionally and physically tough, and the responsibility for human life is immense. The RVS is not just about remuneration for doctors. It is about maintaining high-quality, accessible and affordable healthcare for all Australians so that patients' gaps don't blow out. It's about rejecting the American system that you see on shows like Chicago Hope every week. In effect, the RVS means Medicare and the preservation of Australia's universal healthcare system. Access to quality, affordable healthcare, regardless of means. It will provide security and certainty for doctors and patients well into the future. It is the best chance we have for the foreseeable future to put some science into working out the MBS and where those numbers should be. If the RVS is ignored in the May budget, we will push all the way to the next election and beyond. As the AMA is the only truly independent voice for doctors in this country, we have a considerable voice in the community and we have the best sources of information about the state of the health system, doctors and patients. The doctors in the suburbs and the country towns, in general practice and in hospitals, the specialists, the students, the researchers, AMA members and non-members are all telling us the same thing. The health system needs help. Doctors are being forced out of general practice by rising costs and falling incomes. Many are looking to the corporates, others are leaving the profession altogether. These are all good people committed to their patients who find it is just getting too hard to keep their practices viable to provide the level of service that patients want and deserve. Like the banks, the post offices, the government agencies and Telstra jobs before them, the traditional Australian family practices are disappearing from the landscape. It is the result of a health system in trouble, a health system in urgent need of a checkup and a revival. Any prescription should have discussion of the full and immediate implementation of the RVS at its heart. So far, there's not been any serious response by the Minister to the findings of the relative value study. The cone of silence, just like in Maxwell Smart, has descended. What we can expect to see is some cherry-picking of a few items here and there. But this approach will not be acceptable by the profession. The government used the AMA's goodwill to bring the study to a premature conclusion and to reach compromise positions on a large number of matters and to leave other matters in the disagreed basket. Now, after 4 months of the cone of silence, it is clear that there was little goodwill on the government side. If the AMA had not compromised and the consultants were allowed to come to conclusions on disagreed matters, a 15-minute GP consultation would have come out at around $57, not the $44 that we have discussed. Since the government won't reconvene the Medicare Schedule Review Board to finalise these matters, the AMA has decided to reconvene its own representatives on the board to finalise them. We need an outcome that is realistic for all medical services and which moves extra money into the consultation-based parts of the schedule. And the government has to respond to this so that patients' gaps don't blow out. The AMA believes the implementation of the RVS is essential to the future of Medicare. It can't be done with just words. It needs money, and whichever party is in government after the next election, they cannot afford to ignore it. As I said, the government last week announced a 50-cent increase in the MBS level fee for a Level B consultation and increases in the after-hours rebates. Now, there's no doubt that the after-hours increases are welcome, but it's simply returning some of the funding that was stripped out of after-hours rebates years ago, which was largely responsible for GPs giving up after-hours work. We could have told them that it would happen at the time. In fact, I think we did. And the money was owed to GPs because the budget had been underspent. This is just fiddling at the edges. And it was all brought about because the volume of services under the Memorandum of Misunderstanding was temporarily flat. If the volume of services picks up, there'll need to be cuts in rebates. When this happens, one assumes the government will not announce that decision quite as triumphantly. Of course, the three medical organisations who have signed the MOU will be required to stand beside the government to announce any rebate cuts, just as they stood by to announce the increases. Can't wait to see that. It'll be interesting to see how their members judge them. In our facts poll, around 95% of doctors want the RVS implemented. They want recognition of their work. They don't want scraps from the table. Now, speaking of scraps from the table, I'd like to return now briefly to the public hospital issue. According to the Prime Minister, what to do with public hospitals is one of the most difficult public policy issues he's confronted. Down here, it would seem that private hospitals are getting closer and closer to the policy too hard basket as well. We don't have a national policy on public hospitals in Australia. There is no national set of standards for our public hospitals. Each state funds its hospitals differently. Each state funds its hospitals at different levels. They are organised differently. They count things differently. They report differently. They give access differently. And they cost shift and blame shift differently. They have different beds per population ratios, different waiting times and numbers, and different admissions per population. The Senate Affairs Community References Committee looked at this problem. It recommended that governments tackle these difficult issues and come to some resolution. Several of their recommendations suggest that the Australian healthcare agreements should be broadened out to cover other healthcare programs that representatives of health professionals, for example, should be included in the discussions. And there's no question that doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers have not been listened to enough in changes to the healthcare system. The Senate committee also recommended that an extra $450 million a year over the next 2 years be injected into the public hospital system to offset the serious underfunding which they observed, half the cost to be borne by the states and half by the Commonwealth. Now, when you look at the South Australian budget submission, that $450 million won't go very far nationally. We need national standards against which the performance of the public hospital system can be judged, so that states are accountable, which they're not at the moment, for the health funding they receive under the federal-state agreement. I think perhaps a better description is the federal-state disagreement, because every time there's a problem, each one blames the other for shortfalls, and when you go to one for a solution, they say, oh, it's all their fault. You go to the other one and say, look, this is what they said. Oh, no, that's not right, so it's their fault. So we need better ways to integrate the private hospital system into the overall picture as well. It's obvious that public hospitals will be a major issue in both the federal election and the upcoming South Australian election. The AMA will be lobbying for responsible policies for the long term in this area. And I have to say, I'm pretty sure it'll be high on my list of the agenda when I'm speaking to Dean Brown this afternoon. Now, an issue that's been prominent in the eastern states is the number of doctors suffering under the weight of medical indemnity insurance premiums. The full magnitude of this problem hasn't been felt here yet. There are some protections for country doctors, I believe, but city doctors are starting to come under more pressure. The AMA in South Australia has made calls for tort law reform, something that the federal AMA and AMA New South Wales have had success with in negotiations with the New South Wales government. We hope the other states will follow suit and that the New South Wales initiatives lead to further reform. The blowout in premiums is being driven by relatively few, but an increasing number of very high cost awards, some over $10 million, which the system just cannot afford. And you know that for every $10 million award that is given to, let's say, a baby who is alleged to have been damaged at birth, obstetricians' premiums around the country go up by $10,000 each. Every single award, every single obstetrician's premiums go up $10,000. In New South Wales next year, it's going to look like comprehensive cover for an obstetrician is going to be $100,000 for insurance before they open their doors. If they want private-only cover, it's going to be around the $50,000 mark. How many obstetricians can afford to open their doors and keep on working? And you wonder why GP obstetricians and rural obstetricians are hanging up their forceps. We hope the other states will follow suit, as I said. The blowout in premiums is being driven by relatively few, but an increasing number of high-cost awards. We want to see some common sense. But plaintiffs often get nothing or very little. Legal costs absorb over half of most awards. Only one-third of doctors' insurance premiums are going to compensation awards to patients injured by negligence. The rest goes to lawyers and administration. It's not hard to see what's wrong with this picture. The system is slow, it's costly, it's unpredictable and frequently unfair to the patient, the doctor or both. Because of this situation, some areas of Australia are seeing not just services disappear, but doctors as well. At a federal level, we're pushing for a system of structured settlements for indemnity cases to allow periodic payments to replace lump sum awards. Now, this is such a simple thing. What it means is that if you get a lump sum payment, at the moment you don't pay tax on that. But if you want to take that payment as a series of annual or quarterly payments over the period of your life, you'd get taxed as if it was income. Now all they have to do is say that part won't be taxed just the same as the lump sums won't be taxed, and that will create quite a significant improvement in the bottom line and in medical indemnity payouts. So last night, officers of the AMA were speaking with the federal government about this very issue, and our federal vice president, Trevor Mudge, was there talking to Treasury last night. And we've been given a very sympathetic response to our proposal. This has taken a tremendous amount of work over almost a decade, but I think we are on the verge of a breakthrough on medical indemnity, certainly in New South Wales, and let's cross our fingers for the federal one. In the time I've left, I'd like to touch on some issues that are of a great threat to the unique nature of our health system. First of all, managed care. The Chicago Hope style of medicine, otherwise known as managed care, is of enormous concern to the AMA and should never be allowed to gain a foothold in Australia. I think the hospital in Chicago is called Hope because in the USA, if you get sick, you just have to hope your health insurance is paid up. Managed care is an example of outside influences placing undue pressure on the patient-doctor relationship. In Australia, we don't want US Supreme Court decisions like the one reported in the Medical Journal of Australia on Monday and originally in the Medical Journal... It was reported in the Australian and originally in the Medical Journal of Australia, in which the court ruled that a doctor's obligations to making profits for an employer is more important than a patient's well-being. Go figure. They said that a doctor had asked... the patient had approached a doctor for help regarding an 8-centimetre painful inflamed mass in her abdomen. In conformity with the requirements of the health maintenance organisation, i.e. managed care, which employed her, the doctor performed no investigations over an 8-day period, as a result of which the patient suffered a ruptured appendix. She subsequently sued the doctor and the HMO, claiming that they'd breached their fiduciary duty towards her by putting the quest for profit ahead of her interest. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court found against the patient and said that the HMO had a right to put profits ahead of patient well-being. We don't want that here, but that's what managed care is all about, telling doctors to meet targets and ration treatment to deliver the best results for the shareholders, not the best results for patients. This is not good for Australia. This approach must be rejected at all cost, and the rights of patients must be enshrined. Australian governments have to be convinced to go down the RVS path, the preservation of Medicare path. Protections against US managed care in Australia, such as a universal and accessible Medicare with a strong public system parallel to the private system, are being worn down. The Medicare benefit schedule is increasingly capped, and more restrictions, hurdles and bureaucratic obstacles are put in the way of patients receiving the care they need. In the USA, just 6 health insurance organisations now dominate the health insurance marketplace. If a doctor doesn't have a contract with one of these companies, he or she is out of business, which is why the AMA has fought so hard to make it possible for doctors not to have contracts with health insurance companies. And these organisations can't even be described as health insurance companies because they dictate the level of patient care that can be received based on cost. Doctors and patients are in a take-it-or-leave-it situation under managed care. The company's imperative is to cut costs and boost profits. The doctor's is to deliver high-quality care. It's got to be a collision course. Restrictions on care are not transparent to the patient, and the doctor is in breach of their contract if they advise the patient of the restrictions that are placed on them. All the talk in the US is about getting a patient bill of rights to counteract this. Surely it's not necessary for us in Australia to go down that path before we realise it's too late to go back. The fundamental transaction in the health system is the relationship between the doctor and the patient. The more we interpose payers, governments, bureaucrats, red tape and restrictions on that relationship, the more we diminish it, with inevitable consequences. The AMA believes in the fundamental doctor-patient relationship, and it's worth fighting for. We have and will continue to fight to defend it. This will take vigilance over the behaviour of the health insurance funds and vigilance over the activity of the growing corporate medical entities. Something else the AMA is vigorously defending the doctors against is the unfair application of the Trade Practices Act by the ACCC. The chair of the ACCC, Mr. Alan Fells, has accused the AMA of running a scare campaign of misinformation to rural doctors. The only people scared are the doctors who've had to become trade practices experts if they're to work cooperatively with colleagues on rosters, work sharing, negotiating with hospitals, or determining which patients to bulk bill. The Trade Practices Act was designed to control large corporations, not discriminate against individual doctors trying to do their best to provide services to their patients. And the ACCC simply doesn't understand how medical practice works. Why is it that corporate practices can vertically integrate by including pathology and radiology into their corporate umbrella and set all of their own fees, but a group of individual doctors working as associates in the same small practice, sharing premises, staff, even a computer system, are not even allowed to discuss their fees, and a group of doctors in a country town can't get together to discuss rosters, share workloads, or negotiate with hospitals without risking breaching the Act? That is why the AMA and the Rural Doctors Association of Australia are calling for an independent inquiry into the impact of the Trade Practices Act. Now, if Mr. Fells continues to oppose this independent inquiry, I would have to ask, what is he afraid of? Last week he told a parliamentary committee in Canberra that country doctors should seek authorisations when setting up work rosters. But a separate authorisation, he said, would be needed for every specific situation. Each authorisation costs, conservatively, $25,000 when you include legal fees. So it's a very costly process, and it would be very time-consuming. It would have little chance of success in easing the overall burden on doctors. It could even exacerbate their problems. The ACCC says they haven't prosecuted any rural doctors or GPs yet. How reassuring. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, they tell groups like the AMA in Western Australia that if they try to represent doctors in their negotiations with rural area health services, that they would have to be taken to court to test Crown immunity. Don't call that a threat. The AMA in Western Australia is already up for several hundred thousand dollars in legal fees and is now facing a further fine of up to $250,000 just for trying to assist the state government to attract doctors to a peripheral hospital by negotiating an acceptable contract for specialists. The problem is that partway through that process, the hospital was privatised and Crown immunity ceased, so they got them on a technicality. Our rural doctors are up in arms. We're told of situations like the doctors in the New South Wales Riverina area who are too intimidated to turn up to meetings to discuss the problems in their health system for fear that there will be a conversation at that meeting about rosters or fees or contracts and they'll be prosecuted by the ACCC. They can't ask the AMA to represent them as a group unless they pay for one of Mr. Fell's authorisations or risk a prosecution. The Trade Practices Act is an unnecessary burden on the many facets of the health system. Well, I hope I've made it clear to you today that Australia's health system is at a crossroads. Here in South Australia, you are seeing clearly all the evidence of a system in trouble. It is the same right across the country. We need national solutions. We need long-term solutions. The AMA has presented its case to the federal government, to the opposition, to the other parties. We will continue to do so right all the way to Election Day. We can only hope that whichever party is in government after the next election, that they are committed to building a health system that best serves not only this generation, but the next and the next and the next, and is prepared to listen to the real experts, the doctors, nurses and other healthcare workers. And most importantly, they must listen to patients. We need a health system that works in the best interests of all Australians. A healthy nation is a productive nation. Thank you.
Thank you for that. How'd you like to be Dean Brown this afternoon?
I'm just getting warmed up.
It's traditional that when we have a guest speaker, we throw the speaker to the lion, so to speak. It's also traditional that priority is given to the working press. We've got many journalists here today, or at least at work. Any questions? Can you go down the front?
You hate that? I got two now. We're going to do it.
Brad.
Dr. Phelps, Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. You've outlined a lot of problems in the system, but you've also had a red-hot go at a few of the other doctors' organisations. The College of GPs in particular, which you called one of the three mousketeers, I believe, they've also come back. Their recent magazine accuses you of being hostile, of having poor judgment, of being counterproductive and of pursuing unacceptable tactics. Now, you've quoted a couple of surveys showing the AMA has support, but basically, with all these problems in the system, how can the medical profession as a whole seriously hope to grapple with the government if they're not united?
Can't, and that's why it's been such a divisive procedure. This whole MOU process has been really divisive. The AMA had very real and, I think, very valid concerns about the MOU from its outset. I mean, draft one was an absolute nightmare. Draft two is still working within a very capped budget and doesn't take into account the flexibility that was required into health funding, and also didn't take into account the fact that we were on the threshold of the results of the RVS, which would have certainly indicated a far greater gain for general practice potentially. Now, I don't believe the other organisations foresaw that. And they signed up, I think, thinking that they were doing something for general practice, but forgetting their core business. And as I said, the core business of the college is education and training. The core business of the ADGP, or the Australian Divisions of General Practice, is in service delivery and education to GPs. It is not about negotiating on an industrial level about GP financing. An organisation, for example, like the ADGP, cannot be involved as an independent voice of general practice because they are entirely dependent on government funding for their existence. You can't be a de facto government department and be discussing on an independent basis the needs of your constituents. It's simply not possible.
Yes, hello. My name is Mark Steiner from the Advertiser.
I've had it for a couple of years, and it's about health insurance. I'm not happy about paying it. I don't think there are too many people in the room that are. My biggest concern about that was that effectively I've been forced into paying it by government legislation. If I don't pay it, I'll be penalised for the rest of my life. If I do pay it, I'll be out of pocket for the rest of my life. Isn't it a concern that government is avoiding its responsibility of paying for a good health, public health system by forcing people into paying for health insurance? Now, I can afford it. You know, Mr. Drury pays me quite well. But I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who can't. Also, so far, private health insurance has served me well. There's no problem. What happens when I get older? When they start to say, well, you're too sick, we can't afford to pay it anymore, you're too old, or whatever happens. I'm just concerned that this private health insurance is being used by government to avoid paying for a public health system, which I believe is one of the two or three planks of what government should do. Education, health, social service, all those sorts of issues.
The first thing I'd like to say is that I hope to God, and so should you, that when you're an old man, that there is an AMA who's prepared to tell it like it is and to protect your interests as a patient and to keep the health funds honest and not exclude you from care and not accept managed care in this country. The second thing about private health insurance is that it never seems like good value until you need it. Well, and if you happen to need intensive care, if you happen to be in a major car accident, you want the doctor of your choice and you want to be able to get admitted to a private hospital and to be able to get care with the doctor of your choice in the place of your choice, then you'll say, well, that wasn't bad value. The next thing is that a lot of people in Australia suffer under the illusion that paying their taxes, paying their Medicare levy is going to cover their healthcare costs. Now, the Medicare levy is 1.5%. And healthcare costs are conservatively about 8.5% of GDP, and that's of GDP, not of taxpayers' dollars. So I think that what we have to do is to look at what you're getting for that money and recognising that the Medicare levy is only a part payment towards providing yourself with insurance, and it is an insurance policy. And the only other thing that I would say is that eventually I think with the increase in private health insurance that we will ultimately start to see a relieving of the pressure on the public hospital system, but it needs help now.
But, sorry, some other people want to ask questions, but I'm sure the American Medical Association, or whatever it's called, would have said that about 20 or 30 years ago when medical insurance in the United States started becoming very important there. And now patients are suffering. I mean, fair enough, it's fiction on television, but you see news reports of it all the time. Ambulances are being turned away. Same things are happening here now. What happens to us in 20 or 30 years? And the AMA, for reasons, I presume, in the interest of doctors as well as patients, is one of the advocates of private health insurance. What happens in 20 or 30 years when a large percentage of this population, most of the people who can't afford to pay private health insurance, are left in the lurch?
The whole reason
or when I get old.
Yeah. The whole reason for the theme of my speech is to support the blend of the private and the public system and to make sure that the public system doesn't get neglected, doesn't crumble because of the support going into the private system. We need in Australia, I believe, a blend of the two systems. We need to have accessible and affordable healthcare regardless of your means, so that if for some reason when you're old and the Adelaide Advertiser hasn't paid up your superannuation or if you have spent it all, then you will still be able to get the care that you need. And as I said, you just want to pray that there is an AMA at that time who is prepared to speak up and not have fear that they will be criticised by the college or criticised by the minister because you tell it like it is.
Could I be rightfully angry at the AMA in 20 or 30 years if the system that happens in the United States occurs here and for those 20 or 30 years the AMA...
The AMA is not the policy setter. The AMA can simply advise the community and advise government on what we believe is the appropriate thing for the health system in this country. We will fight. We cannot set the policy. We cannot set budgets. We can simply try to say it as it is. We're an advocacy group. We're not the government.
Thank you for your time.
Tim Lloyd from the Advertiser. I'm wondering whether I should be joining the AMA after your speech today. It sounds very
I think I'm an application form over there.
It sounds very much like it. It is trying to represent doctors, but also trying to represent patients and the general public. And I'm not sure if that's possible. And so I wonder how you rationalise dealing with both sides of your. You know, thank God for the AMA. I don't really believe that. I think the AMA has two conflicting issues that it has to deal with.
There's no conflict whatsoever. I mean, you've got in this room doctors who spend every day of their week advocating for their patients, trying to get your patients into hospital, trying to get them to see the specialist that they need to see, trying to work their way through the system. You have, you know, Michael Rice, the South Australian president, looking every day after children with cancer. He cares deeply about whether those children get the care they need. He cares whether there are clinics that are dealing with developmental problems for children, whether they can get speech therapy, whether, you know, the children with cancer have to wait for treatment or they can get it immediately. I mean, we are happy if they're not happy with their working conditions, which after all are the conditions that they're able to work under to provide care for their patients, then things are going wrong. And, you know, if we have a vibrant and happy and well-motivated medical workforce and we have the rights of patients preserved, the two things do go hand in hand, and I don't perceive at all that there is a conflict there.
I don't doubt the beliefs and the good heart of the doctors. I just think it's very hard for an organisation that represents doctors as a professional organisation to also represent patients and the general public.
That is what
and
we
one
do.
One particular way I'd like to point that out is that the doctors brought in an additional barrier to entry as a doctor by making it necessary to become to go through a postgraduate training course to become a GP. This must have had a great effect on the number of doctors we get. As you pointed out, the expense of having a doctor and so on. I just wonder when these events turn up, shouldn't there be some organisation that just represents potential patients to actually argue with the AMA about its own efforts?
One of the problems is that when you're a patient for such a short time. You know, you're sick or your relative is sick and you go into hospital and then you get better and then you're not a patient anymore. Whereas doctors are dealing every single day with patients. And the issue to do with the provider number legislation was all about making sure that general practice was not only recognised as a specialty but had the training to go with it. The problem you talk about restricted numbers is not imposed by the medical profession, not by the AMA. It is imposed by the government when it says how many training positions it will fund. And we know for sure that South Australia has been shortchanged on the number of GPs it is able to train and to provide for its general practice workforce here. That is determined by the numbers told to the college that they're allowed to train by the minister. And there is now training has now been taken out of the hands of the college and has been put in the hands of the General Practice Training and Education Limited, chaired by Kate Carnell, who are now responsible for competitively tendering organisations to conduct GP training. They have, once again, a limited budget and they have a specific number of GPs that they are allowed to train every year. So the AMA has been advocating strongly on behalf of appropriate numbers of trainees, but we are once again unable to set the budgets and to say how many people can be trained. What I have been able to do is to conduct our own GP workforce survey, because I didn't trust the AMWAC study. I didn't trust the figures that they were coming up with, saying that there's an oversupply of GPs, like it was some mantra that we're just supposed to accept. We'll do our own numbers, thank you very much. We will say how many GPs we feel are needed, and then we can contrast with the department's figures and make sure that they're based on evidence and not on cost and political expediency.
Andrew McGarry from the Australian newspaper. You've been talking today about a series of issues that you'd like cleared up, a series of initiatives that governments of various colours around the country should be contributing to. And given this is an election year, there will be a large number of people trying to tell you that there will be some sort of funding available for things to try and get votes. But realistically speaking, how can you expect an ongoing increase? You were talking about relevant funding to make sure that Medicare survives, to make sure that the various aspects of the medical system survive. How can you guarantee that will happen when all other areas of the budget, give or take maybe defence, are under such constant threat?
Well, isn't it interesting that you can find close to $1 billion by lopping 1.5 cents a litre off the excise of petrol, because the heat was getting a bit hot in the kitchen, and you can't find a similar amount of money to correct the problems in the health system? That money would have solved the problems for general practice immediately in terms of the amount of budget that was needed. So I think that it all gets down to political priorities, and I believe that health is a major priority in the minds of Australians, not just in the minds of doctors and the AMA, but it is amongst the Australian people. Everywhere I go, they are saying how important their health system is to them. And I believe that that government, and any proposed government, needs to recognise that this is such a high priority for Australian people and represents that view. And that I think that it is most unwise for any government to be proceeding without consulting with the peak representative body in the profession. And I have to say that that most areas of government are discussing very widely and extensively with us on this range of issues.
One very quick supplementary. You are speaking with Minister Brown this afternoon. The South Australian government has been crying poor on the health system for quite some time. From your discussions with branches in different states, how do you think SA's situation stacks up against the rest of the country? And do you think that the funds can be got as well in South Australia, or is it just a political line?
I think there are a number of elements in play. I think that, number one, health needs to be put as a very high priority. Number two, as far as South Australia stacks up, you've had a loss of 552 beds since 1993. You've got a waiting list in excess of 1,500 over 12 months, so you've got a trebling of the waiting list. You've got extremely high ambulance bypass numbers, which are getting worse. So I would say that South Australia's got some homework to do, and that it is not just a state issue, it is a state and federal issue. And as I said, the federal-state agreement looks more like a federal-state disagreement, and I would like to see all parties get together, all state and territory governments and the Commonwealth get together and thrash out an agreement where there is some accountability, where the money that is earmarked for health gets spent on health, and where they have to meet national hospital standards. And I think that these are essentials, and I don't think it's as hard to achieve as I'm being told that it is.
Samela Harris from The Advertiser. I'm here to bring the tone of things down just a little bit, because once upon a time we endured the medical mystique, where we placed our doctors on pedestals and communication was minimal because we poor lay people didn't understand very much, and we rather enjoyed that high degree of trust. Now, recently I found myself in the ER and a young chick came up to look after me, and she was called Carolyn. And she was highly efficient and she was extremely competent, but I had no idea she was a doctor. The white coat is gone. We've been writing the paper about the disappearance of the white coat. Now, apart from the fact that the white coat is a great economy in ironing, because after all, it was a definitive mark which separated the working doctor from the rest of the staff. What's your take on this?
Sit back while I tell you a story. When I was an intern, I was about, oh gosh, probably 7 months pregnant, and I was doing paediatrics, and I can remember I had to give a presentation to the grand rounds, and I thought, well, what I'll do is that I'll put on just a, you know, one of the theatre gowns to do my baby checks and do my ward round, and then I'll put on this crisp, freshly laundered white coat to go and present at the grand round so that I'll look really smart and impress the professors. And so I did that, and I put on my coat, and I waddled out the door, about to go on my grand rounds. The sister followed me, and she said, "Dr. Phelps." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "There's one family that wants to take their baby home, but you have to check the baby before you go." So I said, "Okay." So I turned around, and I went back to the baby, and I took off the nappy with inevitable consequences. I hadn't taken off my white coat, and I ended up with nice yellow stuff all over my white coat. So I had to rush around and find a fresh white coat. So that is, in fact, the utilitarian purpose of the white coat, is to protect the clothes underneath. In terms of the symbolism of the white coat, we do know from that particular study that about 60% of patients want their doctors to wear white coats. And I think that the scenario that you describe is possibly this pendulum swinging right back the other way, where there is this familiarity, where some patients actually do like the feeling that they can walk in and call their doctor by their first name and have that kind of peer relationship with them, where, you know, you're seeking advice, you're empowering the patient, they take that information and deal with it. I think in the hospital setting there is a case for revisiting this issue of the white coat, because it is very confusing. I mean, I confused people myself when I was a medical student, because by day I was wandering the wards in a short white coat of the medical student, and then by the weekends I was walking around in a ward clerk's uniform because that was my weekend job. And the hospital actually made me give up one of my jobs, because I was doing a blood runner's job on a Thursday night as well, where I wore the white coat. And they said, "Our computer system can't cope with you having two separate identities in the hospital." So the symbolism of the white coat, getting back to that issue, is I think one that needs to be revisited. But I think it needs to be discussed hospital by hospital rather than having a grand edict from above. And perhaps a survey of the patients in a particular hospital in a particular area. And I think it's worth doing. The other thing I think we could revisit is the design of the white coat, because they are not the most comfortable thing to be doing CPR in, I have to say. If you've got to sort of be jumping up on a bed and doing resuscitation in a white coat, it's quite restrictive. So I think if we can actually go back and revisit the design of the coat, make sure that the doctors are happy wearing it, if it's what the patients want, then, you know, worth revisiting.
We've probably got time for one more question. If there's a tax agent in the office, in the room, or... Suddenly a stampede.
Hi, Dr. Phelps. Cheryl Lee Kerr from the Advertiser. I was actually curious to know where you thought you'd be in, say, 10 years' time, whether you might branch out into politics federally, and maybe whether Prime Minister Karen Phelps has a certain ring to you.
I don't think any of us knows where we'll be in 10 years' time, and I think the pace of life is such at the moment that I don't even dare think about where 10 years might lead me. But in terms of politics, if this isn't politics, I don't know what is. And I think in a position such as this, it is unwise and inappropriate to have any political aspirations beyond what you are doing, because you can't be afraid of offending someone. You have to be able to say without any bias whatsoever exactly what you think of a particular issue at a particular time, regardless of where party politics are at the time. So at this stage, I would have to say no aspirations. I simply want to aspire to doing the best job I can for the medical profession and the patients in Australia for the next couple of years.
Philip Allen from Pathology. This question concerns the recent furor about autopsies, a furor that I believe has been fuelled by inadequate information supplied to the public about relevant autopsy details by the press. Let me give you an example. In the case of a neurological autopsy, the brain is removed from the patient. The brain is soft. it cannot be properly examined for more than 2 weeks. The brain has to be put into a fixative and hardened for 2 weeks. By that time, the patient is already buried. So there is, and this situation has existed for 100 years. It's been standard practice to store these organs, and indeed without storing them, the practice of pathology in that regard is inadequate. After the specimen has been stored for a week and hardened, then it is examined and sections are taken, and the specimen is stored until the case is concluded.
So can I ask you, can we get on with the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
The problem is that because of this, an innocent person, a scapegoat has been found, and that person is in the medical profession. The question is, will you, or will the president of the AMA, speak up for Dr. John Hilton, who has been stood down from his position as Director of Pathology in New South Wales Forensic Services on inadequate grounds?
I'd like to talk to you and your pathology representatives on a private basis about that particular matter, but in a more generic sense, I think that information is important, and I think that that information you have provided to the public today about the reason why brains may not have been returned to the body in time for burial is something that people need to understand, and I think something that patients and patients' families or deceased people's families need to be able to understand, and the only way you're going to be able to do that is through appropriate informed consent and information going to those patients. There, I believe, may well have been a deficiency in the amount of information that has been given to patients regarding autopsy procedures, and I do believe that that can be corrected. Similarly, I think that there has been a paucity of information in terms of auditing of organs that have been retained in pathology circumstances, and that is being addressed appropriately, I believe, by the governments. But it should be in consultation with the experts, who are the pathologists who are working in that field, so that we can understand and the governments can understand without, I think, unnecessary beating up of a story why certain procedures are undertaken. But once again, I think it's a very strong case for patients and their families being informed about what is going to happen in the medical process. And in terms of the specific case, I'll take that on notice and we can discuss that later.
I went to the doctor the other day. I've had the same doctor for 25 years. He's so old, he used to play basketball with Brian. And I haven't been to him for many months. And I went to his surgery, and there was a notice on the door saying that he'd moved around the corner. And I went round the corner, and there was a clinic. And I went into the clinic and announced who I was, and they said, a doctor will be with you in a few minutes. A bloody doctor? I've been going to the same doctor for 25 years, and now I'm going to be given a doctor. I was gratified to hear you say that you don't want to let the medical profession slide down the same trail as the banks and the post offices. I think that was one of the many, many messages that we got out of today's enlightening speech. I'd like to thank you on behalf of everyone here, the journalists, the normal guests, and all the regular guests, and the there are some irregular and some are abnormal, and also those from the medical profession. I think it was an entertaining, enlightening and far-reaching address which we all very much enjoyed. Thank you all very much.
Thank you all very much.
Now, before you all get into a discussion at your tables, I'd like to call up one of Adelaide's most loved people in the media, Rob Kelvin, to come and draw the raffle. Make Rob Kelvin from Channel 9 very welcome. I'd also just like to say that in November I was elected to the board of the Women's and Children's Hospital, and I've got to tell you, it is some challenge. And I was in a meeting this morning at 7 o'clock. I've never been to so many meetings in my life. This is a very serious job that I'm taking very seriously. So I was very interested to hear what Dr. Phelps had to say. And today I feel like my eyeballs are out on stalks because I've never been to so many late meetings and early morning meetings. But it's a big job and I welcome the challenge. Rob, we have some great prizes. Away you go. Give them a bit of a shake. I've given them a bit of a shake up. We have a Telstra Panasonic cordless phone. It's a white phone. That's this one.
It's blue, 93, Janice Coils.
Yes. Where's Janice? There she is, Rob. There she is. Okay, we have another phone from Telstra, Panasonic cordless phone. Wonderful phone. It's a black one.
Aha, yellow. Beg your pardon, blue. It's blue. Blue number 51. Samala.
Okay, we have six bottles of Trilogy wines from Orlando Wyndham.
Blue H36, Irene Worthington.
Irene, come up and get them afterwards. Where are you? Come up and get them afterwards. They're quite heavy. Take them away afterwards. Okay. And another six bottles of Trilogy.
Kim Hume, you number seven.
Where's Kim? There he is. They're up here, Kim. Okay. Walter, where are you? Walter Rogers. Oh. This lovely, lovely man who gives us these wonderful vouchers every press club. Now, Walter's got a $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gouges Street, and it is?
There we go. Red T22, Brad Crouch.
Hey! Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail, medical writer. Some lovely seafood at the Rock Lobster. And also, Walter has a $50 voucher from Ragoni's Bistro in Lee Street for some great Italian.
T59, Patkin.
Patkin.
Patkin? Somebody Patkin.
Who's that? Somebody Patkin, T59. Blue. Patkin. Down there, over there. Here we go. Come down here for your voucher from Walter. Great. And last but not least, we have a carton of Harm Premium from SA Broom, Harm Premium Light.
Sally, I'm sorry. This would be the only thing that Sally's been to this month she hasn't won. It's, what's that, Orange M8 Jane Ferguson.
Oh, up the bank. Okay, thank you very much. Rob, thank you. Thank Rob Kelvin. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance today and see you at the next Press Club luncheon. Thank you.